Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court in special oral submission session has three matters consolidated for argument. They are Rick Perry in his official capacity as governor and Henry Cuellar in official capacity as Secretary of State of Texas versus Alicia Del Rio and others from Travis County. Consolidated with Rick Perry and Henry Cuellar versus Martha Cotera from Travis County. Consolidated with an original mandamus proceeding in Ray Ken Benson and others. The court has allotted 30 minutes for each side to present oral argument and has basically divided the sides into petitioners who are also real parties in interest and relators who are also respondents. Justice Enoch is unavoidably at a relative's funeral today out of state, but he will participate in the deliberation and decisions of these cases. These arguments are being recorded by the court, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments for a nominal fee from our clerk. Court is now ready to hear arguments from petitioners, real parties in interest.
May it please the court. Mr. Taylor and Mr. Terrell will present argument for petitioners, real parties in interest. Petitioners, real parties in interest have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Taylor will open the first 15 minutes, and Mr. Taylor will present the rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the Del Rio case is the earliest filed congressional state case this round of redistricting. Indeed, it is the earliest filed case nationwide, to the best of our knowledge, filed 13 days before the 77th legislature was called into session, filed 3 months before the census data by block level that is necessary to draw congressional districts by the legislature, filed 5 months before the first session ended, filed 7 months before Governor Perry decided that the legislative branch of government would no longer be involved this round in congressional redistricting, and filed 21 months before the election that gives rise to the alleged injury in the Del Rio case. The injury in a congressional redistricting malapportionment case is not that the districts are malapportioned. The injury is that there is an imminent election coming up based on those malapportioned districts, and there's a significant difference. The data that we use in March during the legislative session, that data is based on a census taken 11 months before. For anyone to suggest that when a trial judge in Texas in the coming days draws a congressional plan based on that data is exactly up to date is fooling you. That data is already 11 months behind. And because of population shifts in Texas, the data will never keep up with folks who move around Texas. It's not that the districts are out of line with perfect equality of population. The actual concrete injury is whether or not the legislative branch is not going to get the job done so that there is an impending election based on a district plan that's unconstitutional. Now, of course, because of the changes in population, Texas is now entitled to 32 congresspeople, not 30. But that's for the 108th Congress, not the 106th when Del Rio filed the claim, not the 107th while the legislature was in session, but the 108th, which begins in January of 2003. So the question for this court in terms of ripeness, constitutional justiciability, is whether or not a lawsuit filed on December 27th of last year, in fact, alleges at the time of its filing, as this court has taught us in Waco versus Gibson, was ripe and alleged a concrete injury. We submit that under no set of circumstances is a concrete injury in existence before the legislature has even had a chance.
If it wasn't, when was it right? When were the issues right?
We believe there's no doubt, Your Honor, that it was right on July the 3rd, The reason for that is because Governor Perry elected, and he's the only person in Texas who has this right to so elect, not to call a special session. What that meant is that no longer would the legislative branch of government be involved in the redistricting process.
What if he hadn't sent that letter?
I still believe that a right claim would exist because at some point you've gotten so close to the election that there will be an imminent injury to a voter.
Why wasn't there imminent injury when the legislature went out of session and had not formulated a redistricting plan?
On May the 26th, Your Honor, before Judge Davis in Austin, when we were trying facts relative to the plea to the jurisdiction that we filed, we put into evidence a letter from Governor Rick Perry. That letter was encouraging both members leading the House and Senate to try to continue to work together. In 1971, in 1981, and in 1991, we've never had a congressional plan passed in the first regular session.
Well,
it's always been the special session.
But in Patterson, the ripeness doctrine that we apply in Texas does not require actual injury at the time of filing in order to determine whether a claim is ripe at the time the case is filed. We actually also have the standard that if injury is imminent. Why at that point in time, when we know that we're that far down the process, can we not say that injury is imminent?
I believe that you cannot draw a line at, for example, the end of the first legislative session and expect that rule to apply for every single case that's filed in congressional redistricting decade after decade for this reason, Your Honor. For example, if the facts show that at 11:59 p.m. on sine die, one vote was lacking to be able to get a congressional plan passed, and at 12 o'clock a press conference is held, the governor and the leaders say that they've been able to work together and have a strong belief that a legislative session in special session will give rise to the enactment of a plan, and in fact they meet 2 days later and enact a plan. Those facts I just articulated aren't made up. In fact, if you look in 71, 81, and 91, that's what happened. They worked together and got it done in the special session. It's understandable that the Texas legislature...
But that's a different circumstance than the one we have here, when no progress had been made, apparently.
I agree with that.
So what is wrong with a bright-line rule that would look to sine die and the availability of detailed census data as being the test for testing the ripeness of a case at the time it was filed to challenge rules?
I believe that there would be no reason to have a bright-line rule for justiciability from a constitutional point of view in redistricting. There's no bright-line rule for any other type of threshold case. I believe the rule, Your Honor, is already in the Planned Parenthood case to which you mentioned and in Gibson, because we have to take a snapshot in time of the lawsuit that was actually filed at the time that it was filed and ask ourselves the question, is harm imminent? Now, this court may decide...
I understand, but why wouldn't a bright-line rule in this instance in determining imminent harm, in fact, be helpful to the jurisprudence of the state for in redistricting cases?
Because I think it would depart unnecessarily from the constitutional justiciability rules that you've already laid out for every other type of case
in
Texas. Why
isn't that consistent with the justiciability rules?
Because the consistent rule is whether or not there's a concrete injury at the time the suit is filed. If someone, for example, as in this case, filed a lawsuit on May the 24th in Houston, I believe that the record is clear that a legislative impasse certainly existed by May 23rd because, as the Legislative Council website that we've cited in the brief, asked the court to take notice of, says, all of the deadlines, the milestones, had come and gone by that point. And so, if you believe that a legislative impasse could occur sooner than the governor's decision that the legislature will have no role anymore, then drawing the line at sine die does not take into account, as you said we must in Bland, what facts were in existence prior to the time the lawsuit was filed.
Going back to my question, assuming the governor had not sent a letter and we didn't know whether the governor intended to call a session or not, it's now September, he's not called one, you said at some point that there would have to be a line drawn. And where would you draw that line and why?
I believe, based on past history, it's sometime in the month of August. If the governor does not speak as to whether the legislature will be called back into session, then there's some point at which the judiciary must take over.
Well, how do we pick a day? Is it the
I don't believe
the 5th,
it's susceptible 15th? To a specific day.
Well, how do the courts resolve that?
I think the courts have to take evidence. They have to consider the circumstances of what was transpiring
so
at the time.
So one lawsuit was filed August 15th, the next is filed August 16th. Do we call all the legislatures to testify in a trial and decide what?
I believe if two cases were filed that close together, then there would have to be determination made on pleas to the jurisdiction, if one was even filed, as to whether or not the first filed case was right. In this case, the first filed case, Your Honor, in Austin, was filed last year, not this year. And I might mention, and it's in the record, when another lawsuit was filed one day later, December the 28th, in federal court, in the Eastern District, called Mayfield, I filed a motion to dismiss, and that three-judge panel, consisting of Judge King, Judge Folsom, and Judge Hanna, unanimously said that it was not constitutionally, nor was it prudentially, right. Also, and that decision was on April the 26th in Mayfield, also in Lee, which was filed in March, a federal case, decided the same day, and on May the 8th, a third federal decision, consisting of King, Ferguson,
but
and Smith.
We've got Cotera out there on May 31st. And again, we're trying to get at broad principles of just justiciability and likeness. So what guidelines can you give us?
The guideline is to determine the facts and whether they're right at the time the original petition is filed. This court need not go any further than what is already articulated in Planned Parenthood and in the Gibson case. Subject matter jurisdiction is a threshold question. It cannot be waived. In the Del Rio case, at the time that lawsuit was filed, it was mere speculation, absolute surmise, that the legislature wouldn't get the job done. Our opponents believe that the judiciary, rather than the legislative branch of government, should get the first crack on congressional redistricting. They filed suit before the legislature even had its chance.
The federal court disagreed with that.
Was
the federal court wrong in Mayfield 2?
If you look at the Mayfield 2 decision of Higginbotham, I think it's perfectly consistent with our position. Because in Mayfield 2, Your Honor, it was clear that Judge Higginbotham believed they had subject matter Article 3 constitutional jurisdiction. It's also clear they believed they had prudential jurisdiction.
But Mayfield 2 was filed before the end of the session.
That's right.
After the census, after the district by district census date. That would argue that your art case is the first filed right case.
That's exactly correct. If you combine the Judge King opinion with the Judge Higginbotham opinion, King tells you December's too early, March is too early, and if you look at the Higginbotham decision, it tells you April is okay and May is okay. If you apply those federal decisions together to the state situation, you're correct that the ART case would be the first filed right case, because there was a legislative impasse by the 23rd, and the case was filed on the 24th.
He also rejects the argument, though, that cases can ripen. The cases cannot ripen.
And that's on
contrary to your position.
On prudential jurisprudence, there is a significant difference between constitutional ripeness and prudential ripeness. This court has made that eminently clear in several of its decisions, saying, "No, wait a minute. Subject matter jurisdiction is something we have to decide at the get-go, a snapshot in time. But even if you have subject matter jurisdiction, perhaps there are reasons for judicial economy, for not impetuously jumping in and interfering with the legislature, that we're going to wait. And that's called prudential rightness. And both on the state level and the federal level, we have those differences.
Mr. Taylor, have you established conclusively a legislative impasse on the 24th? You cited in the brief, you gave us a website and told us about the deadline, but is that conclusive or is there a fact question?
We believe it was a conclusive determination.
There is no way, as a matter of law, that the legislature could have, at that point in time, adopted.
That is our position, and I believe that our opponents will concede that point. In fact, our opponents are on the record saying by May 8th, which I think is too early, because by May 10th, there was still time for the House to pass a House bill. By May 18th, there was still time for the Senate to send a bill to the House.
They could suspend the rules. They could suspend the rules.
Absolutely, and that would be a factual determination.
Even on the last day.
That's true.
This court had an opinion that came out May the 19th, I think, and the legislature had no problem reversing it by statute.
You're exactly right that the legislature can suspend its rules. But the question is whether or not at the time the lawsuit was filed on December the 27th, the case was right.
Well, we were asking about May 24th.
On May 24th, it was clear from the evidence below that the legislature was at an impasse during the first session. Now, I argued below and continue to argue today that we think the better rule is when the legislative branch of government is no longer going to be involved. And the governor's the one who makes that call. And he made that call on July 3rd.
The problem with that is it gives him a lot of power over which case is going to be first filed, which case is going to be adopted.
He's the only individual under our Texas Constitution that the voters have empowered to decide if the legislature is going to get the job done or not when it fails to do so in the first session. His decision.
What's the last date he can make that decision?
There is no last date. He could decide that tomorrow.
Or he could decide it up until the end of September?
Yes.
Or even October 1st?
At any time, Your Honor.
And that's the deadline the federal court has set for the state to work out the redistricting.
That is correct.
And
there
he
is
could
a time. Redecide.
He could still call a special session today.
He could.
What would that do to your position?
I believe that the Rivas case would nevertheless be ripe because he has actually said that he won't. So changing his mind doesn't then cause that case to be unripe. We have an election that is coming up and a very real October 1st deadline. And so it wouldn't be moot either.
But it sounds like you want to draw bright lines on that end, but then when you go back to the Galleria case, you don't want to draw a bright line there. You want to talk about probabilities at this end, but on Del Rio, what's wrong with saying that the Texas Legislative Council revised population figures didn't indicate that the case was ripe at that point in time? Why do you have to wait to the formal census data?
Two answers. We are arguing a bright line. The bright line is the date that the lawsuit was filed. To answer your question, though, there was no way to actually give a remedy. The lawsuit was asking for a 32-district plan. We didn't have the data, nor do we legally have the right to put into place the 32-district plan
but
back in December.
But doesn't brightness involve injury? Aren't we talking about injury to the one voter representation?
Absolutely. And the concrete injury is not the existence of a malapportioned district. It's the existence of a looming election with not enough time, and the election is going to occur under that unconstitutional district.
Well, do you have authority for the proposition that that's the injury we look to in making this determination?
I believe Terrazas versus Ramirez would bear that out, that the injury that we're looking for is whether or not there has been a plan that's passed that's illegal, as in Terrazas, which the allegation was, or there's no plan and there's not enough time to get a plan in place before the impending election. My time is up.
Mr. Taylor, let me ask you one more question before you sit down. I'm a little bit confused. In response to an earlier question I asked, you indicated that a bright line rule in redistricting cases would not be appropriate. Yet I think I just heard you say that you are advocating a bright line rule.
Well,
so I'm a little bit confused.
Yes.
Can you straighten that out for me, please?
I will. Thank you, Judge. The bright line rule I'm speaking of is the rule that should apply to all cases, not just redistricting cases. And that is, at the time the lawsuit is filed, was it justiciable? That's what this court has taught us in Gibson, and that's what the rule should be here. I'm not suggesting that redistricting cases should be given some arbitrary bright line rule like sine die, because the facts and circumstances every decade will depend necessarily on whether or not there's a legislative impasse. This time there was on the 23rd of May. Next time there may not be.
Have any Texas courts taught us that bright line rule before this?
I believe the Planned Parenthood case specifically talks about at the time the lawsuit is filed. And so by virtue of those words, I believe we understand from a constitutional power situation, you must make the determination at the beginning. And this court has been clear.
But Mr. Taylor, aren't you taking those words out of context in terms of the way that case was decided? That case was actually decided based on the totality of the record that was presented to the trial court, which meant that testimony that was offered after the filing of the lawsuit was relevant to the determination of rightness.
I'm glad you brought that up. The dissent, specifically Judge Heck, when you were talking about the fact that we've got to be careful when the court sua sponte is deciding whether there's jurisdiction, we need to give every favorable inference to the plaintiffs in the pleading and take evidence.
I just don't read Patterson to stand for the proposition since there was no question about timing in terms of determining the rightness in the case. There was no question of dominant jurisdiction at issue, and I'm a little bit confused by your reading Patterson so restrictively in light of the totality of the Patterson opinion and the way it was decided?
The way I read Patterson, Your Honor, is that the difference between the majority and the dissenting opinion was whether or not the plaintiff had an adequate chance to show jurisdiction. In our case,
well,
they amended twice.
The dissent in Patterson related to standing. It was not a dissent. It was a concurring opinion that related to standing as opposed to ripeness.
And you can see this is not the federal rule.
Well, we believe that the federal and the state rule are coterminous as far as federal constitutional and prudential ripeness is concerned. The differences between the two federal court opinions is that the second opinion is talking about prudential ripeness. The first opinion is talking about Article III ripeness. This court has said that the separation of powers principle stops and prohibits the issuance of advisory opinions. Somebody in the executive branch, like the Attorney General, may be able to give an advisory opinion, but not a court of law. And so for those reasons, the first filed case, the Del Rio case, was not right and should be dismissed. To try to answer your question before I sit down, Your Honor, the fact is it was talking about standing. My point simply is that the words it chose to decide whether you have the power or not is at the time the lawsuit is filed. Because if you do not, you must stop and dismiss the case at that moment. And for those reasons, we ask that the petitions be ruled upon in our favor and that we go to trial immediately in Houston, Texas, as soon as possible. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to direct my argument to the questions that I hear from the court. Number one, we have a difference of opinion with the Attorney General with respect to the date when the suit was right, when any suit could be right. And we do argue for a bright line rule. And the bright line rule is very simple. It is not until the legislature, under its own rules, has had an opportunity to act. The legislature had that opportunity only after Del Rio. And that opportunity ended unless it did something which it had never done before in redistricting, to change its rules. Its rules required that the House act by May 10 on any bill that originated there and by May 18 on any bill sent to it by the Senate. That has never changed in redistricting. That is a time when, under Patterson and Waco, the injury became likely. And the question is whether it's likely, and not that injury had occurred, but whether it's likely, and also whether there is any, and not if there is to be any conjecture about future events.
Well, then why isn't Cotera the first filed right case?
Because Cotera was filed after signing by, but long after the power of the legislature under its own rules terminated on May 18, 13 days after. In fact, ART was filed 6 days after that power terminated.
Well, but we've been hearing from Mr. Taylor in response to some earlier questions that certainly the legislature could have suspended the rules, and so we didn't know that injury was likely at that point in time. What's your response to that?
My response is the legislature could have suspended its rules. The governor could have called a special session. There are many could-haves, but none of them rose to a likelihood enough to defeat the fact that under the rules existing, published for everyone to see, that there was a likelihood of injury at
that
point.
But what if there had been discussions on May 8th that they were close and they would make a decision, but they would have to suspend the rules? Would that affect the rightness decision?
Discussions I don't think would, because you would have to look, in fact, to see if the rules had changed before the rules themselves decided that they could not, that they had not acted. Now, there's always speculation at the end of every session, and there's always speculation about calling a special session, but I really think this court is on a slippery slope, and I do agree with the bright line. If you start supposing about what the legislature might do after its own rules expire and what the governor might do.
Well, isn't it a slippery slope to say that the courts in the state of Texas can be entertaining this issue while the legislature is still in session?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so, because the fact is, under their own rules, the time has elapsed for them to act. Now, it's not to say that they couldn't change those rules, possibly, but it would take a heroic effort to do that. And, in fact, that is more of an effort than one man, the governor, deciding to call a special session. It is more unlikely than the governor calling a special session. because of the politics involved as a practical matter.
But if we're talking about probabilities, what's wrong with drawing the bright line when the legislature, when Sine-Die Day comes up? What's wrong with that?
Because I don't think that it deals with the kind of organic inquiry that this court engaged in other decisions on justiciability.
But doesn't it keep us out of the speculation as to what might or could happen?
I think that going with the legislature's own rules keeps you out of speculation. I think that you are speculating that there won't be a special session if you go with sine die, possibly. There is less speculation, in fact, on the question of whether the legislature is going to undertake an heroic vote, which has never occurred in redistricting. And so I don't think it's changed its rules.
You're still into a swearing match. You're still into prognostication, which you wouldn't be with sine die. Therefore, why not take that course?
No, you're not. Respectfully, you're not into a swearing match because all you have to do is look at the legislature's rules. They are in place. You don't have to take anybody's word for the rule.
Well, let's say there were a bill on the table and there was a tremendous likelihood that they would suspend their rules. Couldn't you have testimony to that effect that there's momentum to suspend the rules and go ahead and pass the plan beyond the dates?
I suppose that we can imagine many things. That would be one thing that we could imagine.
But what if that were the case? What if that were in fact the case? Wouldn't you have people prognosticating about what was going to happen?
I think not. I think that you can have people prognosticate, but I think the court would still have jurisdiction on May 19 if, in fact, that had not occurred by the time that the May 10 and May 18 dates had gone by, which they had here.
What would happen in that event if the legislature then decided to suspend the rules and take on redistricting, and you have a court case pending because it was filed after May 18th, and what would the court do? Would they abate, suspend itself, or what?
Well, first, that's the same question that could come up if you adopted a sine die rule and then the governor called a special session. So that's the problem with bright line rules. But under that circumstance, which has never, ever happened in redistricting, then I think that the court could well lose jurisdiction under an organic test. That's the problem with just saying sine die is ever and ever more the rule. You have to look at the particular circumstances.
So you're saying the opposite then, the court of the other side, the court could acquire jurisdiction on May 19th and then lose it because the legislature undertakes to...
It's possible that that could happen. I can't say that that wouldn't happen. And that's why I think that you need to be careful with bright line rules. But if you go to a bright line rule, you need to respect the bright line rule as it is stated by the legislature, who after all is supposed to, in the hierarchy, be the one to deal with redistricting. There's one other point that I want to deal with, and it deals with your question, Mr. Chief Justice. The federal courts have the same rule as Texas has announced in the Waco and the Patterson cases. It looks to the time, what the situation was at the time the suit was filed. Moore's practice says that. All of the cases that the other side cites...
Moore doesn't cite any authority for that statement.
And all of the cases that the other side cite are not in a dominant jurisdiction context. They're in a judicial convenience context.
But, I mean, it is strange that Moore does have that little paragraph and no cases cited.
Well, they should have cited this
court. Professor Wright has about cases out the wazoo.
I don't want to fight over Wright and Moore. But in any case, I do believe that to follow state court principles is what you're here about. Justiciability is a procedural, quintessential state court issue. And I would ask you to consider, if you consider a bright line rule, the rules of the legislature itself. That's an organic set of rules that can change. You don't have to just go with sine die, which ignores special sessions, but in fact goes with what the legislature itself is doing. And they're the ones charged with this responsibility.
How long do you estimate the trial on the merits will take?
The Austin court did not set a schedule. The Houston court did. The Houston court set an outside time of 2 weeks. In fact, she has allotted hours among the parties that would take less than 2 weeks. So I would say that it would take less than 2 weeks for us to have a decision, all of which is important because of the October 1 federal deadline set by the three-judge court in Tyler.
Is it your view that that deadline, too, has some flexibility in it, that if the courts were on the verge, the state courts were on the verge of getting the plan final on appeal, that the federal courts would be obliged, even if they went forward, to take a look at that plan?
I believe so, because number one, we would not start trial in Tyler until October 15, so you can tack on 15 days. But that aside, there is the United States Supreme Court decision in Grow against Emerson. And in that case, the Supreme Court was pretty strong in saying that the federal courts should stay their hand until such time as within a reasonable time the state, and that includes the state courts, have had a time to act. So if a state trial court were in trial and had a deadline that was reasonably within October, I think the federal court should not act.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from the relators' respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Smith will present arguments for relators' respondents.
May it please the court. The rule being advocated today by the governor and the secretary of state with respect to rightness is, in my opinion, and I think this is supported by the case law, an utterly new rule, a rule with no basis either in the case law of this state or in the federal case law. And it is a rule that is being advocated primarily because it serves their purpose of being allowing them as defendants to pick and choose when and where they're going to be sued on congressional redistricting. That rule, as I say, is completely unsupported in the case law. There is not a single case cited in any of the briefs filed in this court.
How do you characterize that rule?
The rule, as I understand it, would be that if an original petition is filed at a time when the case is unripe, nothing that can thereafter happen can ever bring that case into the jurisdiction of the trial court. For example,
Let me just ask you, do you agree with the distinction they've drawn between constitutional rightness and prudential rightness?
There is such a distinction, Your Honor, but there is no case in the federal system that has ever relied on that distinction for these purposes.
Let's say you acknowledge that distinction and you think it has some merit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then for prudential reasons, why would we do a relation back doctrine for rightness to allow Del Rio to become right for dominant jurisdiction purposes? Wouldn't that allow then preemptive suits now to be filed for the next census 10 years later?
Your Honor, if assuming that Del Rio was not ripe in December, and I think that's an open question, although I don't think the court needs to reach it, the right way to deal with it was to have a plea to the jurisdiction set for a hearing immediately. What happened instead here was the plea to the jurisdiction was filed in January, but it wasn't set until May.
But my question is, it seems to me those are two distinct inquiries that the court has to make.
Yes.
Whether for dominant jurisdiction purposes and prudential reasons, even though a case may ripen for constitutional ripeness, that for prudential reasons we should not allow the type of forum shopping that relation back would permit.
Well, Your Honor, it may well be that if you hold that the case was not fully ripe for all purposes until May 8th, but that it should not relate back for dominant jurisdiction purposes, but there's no reason to say that the Del Rio amended petition filed on May 8th, which was full, at a time when it was fully ripe, there was a complete legislative impasse, and everybody knew there was not even a serious proposal being floated in the legislature for a congressional map. That petition is the second petition filed in any court in the state of Texas, and there's no reason why that one should not be treated.
You're talking about the amended petition?
Yes, Your Honor.
But again, that's relating back. That's arguing for relation back, and my question to you is, isn't that a bad precedent for prudential reasons because it allows forum shopping?
I don't think I'm arguing for relation back because I'm saying that the date ought to be May 8th. It should not be December 27th, and that the amended petition, it should not make a difference whether you file it with the old docket number or a new docket number. You file the petition which relates jurisdictional facts which are valid and make the case ripe as of that date, that a rule that says because you chose...
So then you agree with their argument that you look at the likelihood of the legislature acting?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It is a clear question of likelihood and of the failure of the legislature to do its constitutional duty. And
but
the
that's
likelihood
just imponderable, whether they will really do it or not. I mean, they've been talking about they wouldn't.
Well, it is a difficult question, and if the court is of the view that a bright-line rule should be adopted, it seems to me very clear that the only serious candidate for a new bright-line rule would be the sine-die rule, which is supported here both by Speaker Laney and by, it looks like, Lieutenant Governor Ratliff in his most recent filing, a rule which gives a certain amount of respect to the whole legislative process and says, we'll let you finish it, get to May 28th, go home, and then the case would be ripe.
The problem with that rule is suppose they say on sine-die, we got 95% of the way there, as they have in the past. but we can't finish it until a special session. The governor says, don't leave Austin. It starts on Monday.
Well, I think if that was, you could have a bright line rule with an escape clause, which says if the governor and the legislative leaders are looking like they're about to keep going, then that's not really sine die. But in a situation like this one, where the impasse was just as clear on May 8th as it was on May 24th, as it was on May 28th, the governor then says, I'm not even going to call you back into session until you show me that the two parties can get together and come up with a map. Something that there was never any real hope of happening. In that situation, it would seem like sine die would be a good bright line rule if you want to go with a new rule.
Is there any jurisprudential justification for spending this much energy litigating the forum, the selection of the forum?
Well, you know, redistricting cases are a relatively unusual animal, and this kind of thing does happen.
We're of the opinion, but maybe we're not well informed, that in most states there's some administrative rule that takes care of cases of statewide importance. But is this kind of litigation common around the nation?
It is somewhat common, Your Honor. There are many states, though, where the rule is that you bring a case of this kind in the state capital, which solves the problem. And so, you know, that would be, I don't think the court can necessarily adopt a venue rule like that, but you know, in terms of trying to minimize the problem, a bright line that says, while the regular session is in session, we'll respect the legislature, but within, unless absent special circumstances, we will assume that the litigation process begins if the legislature has failed its duty on the date of its adjournment.
If there is this body of jurisprudence out there from the states that don't have that kind of rule, have any principles developed that we could look to?
I don't know of any cases which specifically address the question of how you apply the usual ripeness, likelihood of imminent injury test in the redistricting context. But it is very clear that there have been a number of cases that have been filed during legislative sessions, including Terrazas 10 years ago.
But Terrazas was an attack on the method the legislature was using. It's entirely different.
But it is not unusual for cases to be filed at a time comparable to the May 8th filing, which is to say everybody knows the legislature is about to end and the process is about to fail, and there's no particular magic to that date. That's the way the usual ripeness rule works. It has the downside of being relatively vague. On the other hand, it is the way the rule has worked in every other context. And
if
so,
the Associated Republicans of Texas had filed a suit on May the 7th in Harris County, would that have trumped?
It certainly would have been ripe, Your Honor. I don't think that May 8th was the day that week was the week when bills had to be out of committee to have any realistic prospect of going through, either in the House or the Senate. By that time, it was completely clear to anybody who was observing the process. But I wouldn't say that the 8th and the 7th is some magic line. I do think these things have a certain amount of gray area if you're talking about a likelihood of imminent injury test. If they had done that, I think that they would probably be in a dominant jurisdiction.
What is the rule of dominant jurisdiction that should be applied? First filed or first ripe case filed?
I think, Your Honor, it makes sense to the general rule, by the way, of dominant jurisdiction is even if your initial petition is defective and doesn't state a valid claim, if you later on fix it, there is a relation back. That's what Cleveland v. Ward says.
But that's a defect in pleadings.
Yes, Your Honor, and it may well make sense to say you can't acquire dominant jurisdiction if you don't have jurisdiction. I don't have a problem with that. In this instance, then, if the court would, it really doesn't make a difference if the court thinks there was valid jurisdiction of the May 8th pleading.
Your point is that you agree that the dominant jurisdiction rule should be the first ripe case filed.
I do agree with that, Your Honor. I think that is not a problem. And I think then the only real argument that the defendants have here is that somehow you should ignore a petition that was filed on May 8th because it was filed in the existing litigation rather than as a new case. There is no such law.
Just to be clear, are you conceding that the December 27th filing of the year 2000 that when that was filed, the case was not right?
I do not concede that, Your Honor. I don't think it needs to be decided, but because of the nature of the right at stake, which is a twofold right under the U.S. Supreme Court's case law, it's a right not just to vote equally, but to be represented equally, to live in a district which has the same number of inhabitants as the other people's districts. But I think the injury is ripe the minute that it becomes clear what the census figures are going to show, that you are living in an overpopulated district, you are then less well represented than people in smaller districts.
So you don't think you ever have to await the legislative process on redistricting?
I think you're entitled, once the census numbers come out, to get a declaratory judgment that there's an injury occurring that is a violation of the one person, one vote.
And the legislative process has no bearing on that.
It doesn't prevent you from getting that limited relief. I think that you could not, the courts could not properly at that point order into place a new map until the legislative process has
ended. Well, if they couldn't order one, then why is there jurisdiction?
There's jurisdiction to declare that the violation is occurring and that the state has an obligation to fix it. But I think then the proper thing for the court to do is to allow the legislature its regular session to fix it and then to go forward if it doesn't do so.
Well, but that goes back to the argument you could file that Justice O'Neill expressed, that you could file tomorrow for 2010 and just wait.
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has said the census numbers are presumptively, conclusively presumed valid for 10 years. And so until the next census numbers come out 10 years from now, if the districts are equal under this census, there is no way to challenge them until the next census comes out. So
that filing the day before the census figures come out would not be right?
Well, it was probably not right for 12 hours. It was right the next morning.
Okay, so you agree on the 27th it wasn't right?
If it was, the numbers were not out for 24 hours after that, I don't think that makes a difference because I think cases can ripen, but if there were such a rule that they can't, then it was not right the day it was filed. That's
correct.
Well,
I was interested in your opening statement that the rule that ripeness is determined at the time of filing suit is not supported by any authority, and so I'd like for you to tell me what you think about what we said at Gibson.
Well, Your Honor, Gibson was a case where there was only one petition filed and there was no argument about any subsequent developments making the case ripe. When the case got to this court, the issue of ripeness was raised for the first time on appeal, and the court said that we will undertake a review of the record to see if there's any evidence in the record. All of the evidence in the record was before the original petition because the petition had been dismissed. There was no factual development in the trial court. And the court said that we will look at developments before the single petition that was in existence. It based that decision on the Texas Association of Business decision. If you go back and look at that, which is cited about a dozen times in the Gibson case, what that decision says, Justice Cornyn's opinion says, it is reasonable to expect plaintiffs, when jurisdiction is challenged in the trial court, to include in their petition the jurisdictional facts that establish jurisdiction. And the reason that that is reasonable is because plaintiffs in the trial court have the opportunity to amend their petition to add any jurisdictional facts they need once the jurisdictional issue is raised. And so that opinion is fully consistent with the proposition that an amended petition can establish jurisdiction even if there wasn't jurisdiction on the basis of the original petition. And then when we get to the Waco-Gibson case, the court, there was only one petition, and I think what the court was doing was saying, we will look at the facts that existed by the time you filed your one petition. If you're talking about things after that, we're going to send it back without prejudice and say you can file a new case with a new petition and rely on new facts. But there's nothing in the case that dealt with the question of developments after the petition was filed, and nothing in the case that dealt with the significance of an amended petition because there was no amended petition. If any language in
well,
that
but
case...
Well, but that's not the question is, if you can amend, what facts can you put in your amendment?
That is the question.
Do they relate only to the facts that existed at the time the suit was filed or before, or do you have the opportunity to put in new facts so you say, in your view, we're now ripe, but for purposes of jurisdiction, don't you decide when it's filed?
Well, Your Honor,
we have some cases that say that, even in Texas.
The cases are entirely on the other side, Your Honor. Going back to 1889 in the Dalton versus Rainey case, this court said that this was a case which was brought before to collect a debt that hadn't come due yet. And when it got up to this court, they argued that the case should never have been within the jurisdiction of the court because it was filed prematurely. And this court held in 1889 there was an amended petition that was filed after the debt became due, and therefore there was no problem with the case having gone to judgment and no basis to overturn the judgment. In 1954, in the Texas Employment Commission versus Stewart Oil case.
But none of this answers the jurisprudential reasons for dominant jurisdiction, determining that you can't ripen over time for purposes of determining dominant jurisdiction.
But, Your Honor, I don't think there's any prudential or policy reason why a subsequent petition, which alleges valid jurisdictional facts and could just as easily have been filed with a new docket number instead of an old docket number should be ignored for purposes of dominant jurisdiction. It doesn't accomplish
anything.
Well,
except for the very purposes that we have a question about here, and that is, what would preclude then someone from filing today with the 10-year later census?
Well, there are two things. It would be dismissed because the motion would be, the plea to the jurisdiction would be heard, and it would be dismissed, so it would accomplish nothing in that way. And second of all, under the rule that I've espoused here in response to Justice Hankinson's question, the filing today wouldn't do any good because the rule is the first right petition that I would advocate, not the first petition. So there is no policy problem with a rule that says an amended petition can count.
Well, it sounds like you're abandoning then the problem that it wasn't right at the beginning, but it relates back. You're relying now on a whole new proposition of when was it likely that the legislature wouldn't come up with a plan.
I think you can look at the amended petition independent of whatever happened in the case beforehand, and if it was right, there is no earthly reason why that petition should not have the same respect as an original new petition
so
in a different case.
So the answer to my question is yes.
I think so, Your Honor. Yeah, but I don't know that it's a new argument. I think it's the argument I've intended
to make.
Well,
I didn't mean new, but there, you did make the argument, at least I read it in the briefs, that somehow the Del Rio case could ripen for dominant jurisdiction purposes by a subsequent filing. And I hear you now saying that's not the case, that the rightness increase can depend on what the legislature was doing at the time.
Well, that is how it ripens, Your Honor. It ripens from between, assuming it wasn't ripe in December, it ripens between December and May by virtue of the fact that it was unlikely.
But you're not claiming that it relates back so that it became the first filed right case as of December 27th. You're claiming it was the first filed right case as of May 8th.
Assuming it wasn't ripe in December independently, that's
understand.
Right. I'm not asking the court to say we can file an unripe case and get the benefit of that date. I don't think that makes any sense.
Okay, you're not saying you're saying that we should just pretend like December 27th never happened and treat the amended petition as if it were an original petition, and that you claim that May 8th was the first filed ripe case, Del Rio's amended petition. Is that what your argument
yes,
is?
Yes, Your Honor. And independent of whatever happened in the case beforehand, and if it was right, there is no earthly reason why that petition should not have the same respect as an original new petition
so
in a different case.
So the answer to my question is yes.
I think so, Your Honor. Yeah, but I don't know that it's a new argument. I think it's the argument I've intended
well,
to make.
Well, I didn't mean new, but you did make the argument, at least I read it in the briefs, that somehow the Del Rio case could ripen for dominant jurisdiction purposes by a subsequent filing. And I hear you now saying that's not the case, that the rightness increase can depend on what the legislature was doing at the time.
Well, that is how it ripens, Your Honor. It ripens from between, assuming it wasn't ripe in December, it ripens between December and May by virtue of the fact that it was unlikely.
But you're not claiming that it relates back so that it became the first filed ripe case as of December 27th. You're claiming it was the first filed ripe case as of May 8th.
Assuming it wasn't ripe in December independently, that's
right.
I'm not asking the court to say we can file an unripe case and get the benefit of that date. I don't think that makes any sense.
Okay, you're not saying it. You're saying that we should just pretend like December 27th never happened and treat the amended petition as if it were an original petition, and that you claim that May 8th was the first filed ripe case, Del Rio's amended petition. Is that what your argument
yes,
is?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think there is no case in this court, in this state, and no case in the federal system that has ever said that such an amended petition or complaint doesn't count for purposes of ripeness or somehow should be treated as a nullity.
As to the date of this, both what you and the opposing counsel share in common is you both say that you look at when the legislative process is not fruit. You said that a signing guy rule would be a good bright line rule, but any of these other states that have the same kind of problems we do ever used a signing guy test?
I'm not going to be able to cite a case that says that. I think that this might be a new idea of a state Supreme Court coming in and saying we're going to establish our own specific rule for that purpose. But I do think that if you're going to be doing that, and there's a lot to be said for that, clearly that is the only good candidate for such a rule. A rule that says a governor's letter sometime later on that announces that he doesn't have a current intention of calling a special session can't, it seems to me, be a very good alternative bright-line rule for a couple of different reasons. If you look at that letter, first of all, it says it currently doesn't seem to me like you're going to do any good to call a session, and so I'm not going to call a session at this time. So the letter itself is somewhat tentative. And it also has no legal consequence. I think, as Mr. Taylor conceded, he could have changed his mind 5 days, 5 minutes later. It's not like it's an official act that somehow he has ceded his authority back to the legislature.
What if he calls a special session tomorrow morning?
If he calls a session tomorrow morning, then I would think that whichever state court has dominant jurisdiction ought to stay its hand to see what happens. And if there's a new redistricting plan passed, then they'd have to have amended petitions challenging that if somebody wanted to do it. But
who makes the ultimate decision? Is it the Secretary of State? Let's suppose there's a court judgment and a legislative enactment at the same time, and we're running up against an October 1 deadline.
I would think that if the Secretary of State might, well, that's an issue of state constitutional
we hope
law.
We don't
I'm not sure
that.
I'm in a position to answer your
question. Do you agree with Mr. Terrell that if the state courts are close, the federal courts either ought to defer or at least give respect to the progress that the state system has made?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that, Your Honor. I think the federal panel headed by Judge Higginbotham is likely to be reasonable on that subject in this instance.
Concerning relief, we have indicated pointedly that appellate courts ought to be reluctant to interfere with competing trial courts that have same subject matter pending. Why should we do so in this case?
I think we face a very unusual situation with the federal deadline coming up on a matter of intense public importance. And that, I think, is why we thought it was appropriate for us to proceed here from Harris County by way of direct mandamus, which, you know, ordinarily wouldn't have been procedurally appropriate. I think that in the interests of the public interest and the interests of the state in making sure that there is a single plan that is drawn by a state court prior to October 1st, it would only be the sensible thing for this court to clarify matters as soon as possible and let this process go forward.
Well, maybe it would be better to litigate it in two courts, get two courts of appeals looking at it, and maybe we would know more the other way.
Well, but you have the scenario. Say the two trial courts on the 25th or the 26th of September each pick a different map, and appeals are filed, nothing's done to change that situation, and the October 1st deadline comes. I think that the federal court in that situation, in view of the fact that there are federal rights at stake and impending deadlines, is very likely to say, well, we're just going to throw the state stuff out and start over. We'll draw the map, and that wouldn't be a particularly good outcome for the federalism concerns that animate Roe v. Emerson, the Supreme Court case that led to this kind of two-stage process. So I think if the state wants to get the most bang for its buck in terms of its opportunity to get the maps drawn in state court, it ought to have a single court doing it rather than two. But there might be an alternative way, which is to say to have the two judges hearing the evidence and then a process of resolution at the end. Indeed, I suppose they could sit together and we could see what happens then. Those are all possibilities, Your Honor, but it seems to me that probably the most sensible is to have one trial. We're going to have to do a lot of traveling back and forth between Austin and Houston if they both go to trial the same day. In terms of the...
But that reminds me, what evidence did you have in the abatement hearing in Harris County about that, traveling, et cetera, between Houston and Austin if the cases go to trial at the same time?
Is the question what evidence did we put in
yes.
about that? I don't know that there was any formal evidence put in. We certainly... I think both judges are aware that we're up against a very tight deadline and that the trials have to go forward immediately, and Judge Bland has given us about 51 hours of trial time to share among all the multiple parties that are in that court. And so I don't think there's any reasonable dispute that it would be somewhat of a hardship to try to have both trials going on at the same time, although I guess they could go in reverse order. We do have a lot of lawyers on both sides of the case. It's also fair.
Well, I just remember from the old days in docket announcements when a lawyer would come in and say, well, Judge, I can't go to trial here because I'm going to trial Monday morning in Judge Baker's court. And the answer was, well, I noticed you're with Baker and Botts or so-and-so, and there's lots of lawyers there. Why don't you just send one of them over there? And you answered my question. There are plenty of excellent lawyers that know what's going on here. Why can't you try two cases in two courts at the same time with the similar parties and the same issue?
I don't think there would be any way that would be impossible. I think it is possible that we'd have to coordinate the witnesses much more than the lawyers, to be perfectly honest, and we'd have to basically say maybe...
But that's not impossible either, is it?
Not a bit, not a bit. That's certainly doable.
As far as the two judges sitting together, I read an Illinois case once where state and federal judges sat together and then rendered separate judgments.
Yes, Your Honor.
Also, evidence together. Is this a common practice?
It's not a common practice, but that happened in the mid-60s, and it happened again about a week ago in Oregon, where the federal three-judge panel that was sitting waiting, kind of like the one in Tyler, called up the state judge and said, let's all get together and see if we can resolve this together. So they have a four-judge panel in Oregon approaching the issue as well. This Grovey Emison thing is something we're all experimenting with because it was only decided in 1992, essentially after the litigation round last time. And how this will play out, it may well be that the dynamics of the process will push in that direction of greater state-federal cooperation because otherwise you have this oddity where you have a state trial and then you go straight to federal court and it's not clear where the state appellate process comes out of that as well. So anyway, that is something that may happen.
Will the witnesses in both trials be essentially the same?
I believe they will, Your Honor.
And how long do you anticipate the case will take to trial? Do you agree?
Well, we do have this 51-hour allocation in Judge Bland's court. Judge Davis has been less specific, but I think we're talking about a trial that will last somewhere between 6 to 8, 9 trial days in that range. The judges seem to be in a posture of keeping pretty tight rein on us, and even though there's probably 10 or 12 expert witnesses, the time is very, very carefully allocated, at least in Houston. I just wanted to make one other comment with respect to the
governor. Is there any reason why either case should not proceed immediately to trial as soon as we rule?
No, Your Honor, just enough time for us to know where to get to and get our exhibits and our witnesses lined up. I think everybody's anticipating the possibility of a quick ruling, and I know both judges are anticipating the need to go to trial as soon as there's an indication of where that should occur, or in both places. If there are no further questions, then I think...
Anything further? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
There's an important public policy consideration with respect to ripeness, and that's the concept of filing prematurely placeholder lawsuits.
Let's talk for a minute about dominant jurisdiction. Do you agree with your opponent's statement that the rule should be the first filed right case?
Yes.
Why isn't the May 8th amended petition the first filed right case?
Because that petition amends a lawsuit that was originally filed on the 27th of December. The trial court's obligation under this court's jurisprudence was to dismiss immediately.
But
it
if
could
the trial
not go
court
forward.
Didn't dismiss and the case remained pending, why would an amended petition be treated any differently than the filing of an original petition?
The amended petition, to the extent that it alleged facts prior to the existence of the original petition, would be something that an appellate court and the trial court could take into consideration. Here, the amended petition on May the 8th alleged only facts that occurred after the original filing.
But it is an amended petition alleging the events as they existed on May 8th. If that had been filed under a new cause number, would that then be the first filed right case?
If a new lawsuit had been filed on May 8th, it would have been the first filed case, but not right case, because as I argued earlier, it wasn't until the 23rd of May that a legislative impasse occurred.
But I'm still very confused about why we are going to treat an amended petition, which supersedes under Texas law the original petition, any differently than the filing of an original petition. Now, we can argue about whether it was ripe on May 8th, but I don't know of any Texas law that requires us to treat an amended petition any differently than an original petition.
The amended petition on May 8th would relate back to the December 27th filing.
But why?
That lawsuit
why?
Had no jurisdiction.
Why?
Because this court has told the other courts that they must dismiss and take no further action.
But it was not dismissed, though. But if it had been dismissed, then that would be a different matter. It was not dismissed. So the case remained pending whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction during that 6-month interim period of time. So why, when the May 8th amended petition was filed, did that not then attach jurisdiction as of May 8th? Not any earlier date, but as of May 8th.
It doesn't, because it did not allege a concrete injury as
okay,
of
well,
May
that's
8th.
The right, that's the rightness question, but I understand that. But I'm just talking about the procedural aspect, because I understand you to say that because rightness is at issue, we should treat an amended petition in a case that has not been dismissed, even if it should have been, differently than had it been filed as an original petition under a new cause number. And I'm having a hard time understanding that distinction procedurally.
Well, whether that you accept that distinction or not, the outcome is the same. Whether it was filed separately or amended, it should be dismissed.
Is there a distinction or not?
I believe that there is, because I don't believe that you can have a policy when you have no Article III jurisdiction in federal court or Article I jurisdiction here to continually amend lawsuits that aren't ripe in the first place.
Well, if there were a brand new lawsuit, there would be citation issues, right? And
yes.
A period to answer the lawsuit.
Yes.
That's at least one distinction.
Yes. Also, my opponents talk about an escape clause. I think the concept of sine die is something that the Texas legislature could embrace if it wanted to, or a mandatory venue provision in a particular county. They could do that if they wanted to, but not this court.
Counsel, we can't do that, and both of you all seem to agree that the better rule would be to look at practical impossibility and not after they get through with all their parties and pack up and go home. Your argument seems to be based on the rules of the legislature itself, and when that is impossible under a structure without some deadlines being suspended by an extraordinary vote of both houses. And your opposing counsel seems to be based on utter lack of activity that makes, based on predictions in the past, impossible. Is there a record in the trial courts of these various arguments? In other words, you're both asking for a factual determination of one sort or another. Do we have a record?
Yes.
We have testimony from legislators, or what do we have that tells us
are,
a lack of that this prudential rightness?
Yes.
We have,
Your Honor, in both cases are exhibits that have been introduced, and then also the legislative website that was printed and put before the courts, giving them notice of the deadlines. The reason why we argued sine die was artificial was because it ignores whether or not there's been a legislative impasse prior to that time. In Carstens versus Lamb, I want to give you a cite, 543 Federal Sup 68, it's a three-judge panel decision out of the Colorado Federal Court, which we cited in our brief. They look at legislative impasse, and they said a case filed during the session in light of the evidence presented at the trial court was one to give a right claim.
But you admit that under Judge Heck's scenario, even under your rules, if they were taking votes on amending these deadlines to bring up a new bill, we could easily end up in a situation that would be fact-based, and we'd have to review that determination. And if we had several courts going and they came up, they made several different factual determinations, and we don't have constitutional authority to review those, we could be in a mess.
That could be very difficult. All I can add is that under the Bland case, this court said that in certain circumstances, the trial court must hold an evidentiary hearing to determine its jurisdiction when it's ruling on a plea to the jurisdiction. We had hearings in both courts in these cases, and
but
we
I
review
think
that.
But I think Chief Justice's point is that would impact our jurisdiction to review the trial court's determination. So do you actually want this to be a factual inquiry?
Well,
we can't look at it.
I understand, but Your Honor, the best I can say to that is that the Waco case, the Planned Parenthood case, the other cases all stand for an important proposition. We're not going to allow the policy of frivolous premature filing, because that's not healthy, it's not good, and it's not subject matter jurisdiction. And that's what happened in this case.
How is that ever resolved? Let's suppose you have three trial courts in three different CA jurisdictions. Each of them takes testimony from the legislators and picks a different impasse date. It's taken up on appeal. Each of the courts of appeals affirm three different impasse dates. Now, what do we do with that?
Well, I think as in this case, You would, of course, have the ability to decide which case was justiciable, which case had constitutional.
But there are factual findings in each case supported by the evidence.
I understand.
There is evidence.
Yes.
So what do we do?
To answer your question, you have jurisdiction to review whether the Court of Appeals correctly or incorrectly determined whether the trial court had jurisdiction.
But that would entail a factual sufficiency review, which we don't have jurisdiction to do.
Right. I'm about to answer that part. And on the question of the facts before those courts, Judge Bland in Houston made a factual determination that her cases predominated over the other cases. And under this court's jurisprudence, when there are two competing cases and one trial court says, I've got dominant jurisdiction, then that court has dominant jurisdiction.
Well, but Judge Davis made the same determination here, and his would have dominant jurisdiction under that scenario as well.
There wasn't a plea in abatement on dominant jurisdiction in Travis County that is
but
on appeal here.
But both courts decided that they had jurisdiction, so that throws us into the same quandary.
But the Austin court didn't decide that it had dominant jurisdiction. Only the Harris County court did. The Austin court decided that it had jurisdiction to Katerra and Del Rio because I filed pleas to the jurisdiction on behalf of the governor and the secretary. But in Houston, the trial judge found that those cases did not have jurisdiction, at least the first one, Del Rio, and so her case was the first filed right case and had dominant jurisdiction based on a plea in abatement that she overruled.
The state's willing to live or die by the first determination by any of its 600 trial judges. With this type of jurisdiction, that they have dominant jurisdiction.
The state is willing to abide by which of these cases was the first right dominant case, and we believe that that's ART.
The policy, one policy in Abler versus Black,
yes.
Is that it doesn't hurt a thing, and maybe it'll help something for the two cases or the competing cases, however many there are, to go along as much as they can. Does that counsel against granting relief to relators here?
Yes. Legally, there is not the type of conflict this court has previously embraced, like one court enjoining another court, etc. We have, for example, 17 expert witnesses in this case, but only one witness can be on the stand at the same time. So we can try this case in Austin, and
you
we can try this case in Houston.
You agree that the witnesses would be essentially the same in both cases?
Yes.
However many cases?
Yes.
Would this court have any authority to order one judge to go to the other judge's jurisdiction or a neutral?
No.
The reason
the reason why not is there are appellate decisions which say that a Travis County judge cannot sit outside of Travis County. So there's no way to try both cases simultaneously. We have to pick Houston or we have to pick Austin. So if both are going to go forward, then we're just going to need to try to cooperate. And I might add that those trial judges have cooperated extensively. In fact, when I used the word in one of the hearings before Judge Davis that there was some interference of trial settings, he corrected me. He said, there's no interference here. We're cooperating fully. And so I believe that those courts will cooperate and that we could try the case in both places at the same time. Having said that, we believe that it would be in the taxpayer's interest to try this case in one place, one time, and that's Houston, Texas.
Governor Ratliff has made that argument in his filings, and the governor agrees with that. The governor and the secretary. You represent the governor and the secretary.
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the oral arguments in these consolidated colleges, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right.